Welcome to the 30 to Life podcast, where we break stereotypes, build legacies, and help others along the way. It's your boy Mookie.
And your favorite color in the world, brown.
And thank you for tuning in to another episode of the 30 to Life podcast, where we redefine the Black experience. I just want to stop and say thank you to everyone. This is episode 95, five away from 100.
Dang.
100 episodes of doing this, of just redefining Black experience, breaking boundaries, helping others along the way, breaking stereotypes. Like, we really been getting great feedback from everyone who's listening right now, helping people learn about so many different industries and really just building wealth, right? And changing the narrative in terms of what the Black experience is. So we really want to appreciate it. So don't be stingy, share this episode. So before we bring on our amazing guests, right, to talk about the R word, I'm not going to see what the R word is, but I'll bring it up a couple seconds. But let me check in with your favorite color in the world.
Yo.
What's up?
What's going on, man?
Yeah, what's up, man? You've been working hard lately, man. Like, you taking mental health day? Like, what are you doing? What are you doing?
No, I need one. But I'm going to take a mental health day in June. I gotta keep grinding till then. But guess what, man? The book is coming out on Sunday. My children's
book. Let's go.
I'm so hyped.
Well. Can you tell the people what more about this?
I've only told, you know, a certain few people as of until recently, but I have a children's book. It's called Daddy's Weekend. It's coming out on Sunday, so be on the lookout for Amazon and hopefully I'll have it on Walmart, but Amazon first. But yes, I'm very excited. Long time coming. This book really came to me in a dream, and to see it actually like in physicality is pretty awesome. Shout out to my illustrator. We were patient with each other, but definitely I'm just happy for this project to come out, man.
Yes, everyone. Yeah. We will have more information about it. We're gonna have to have a barbershop talk to go more in deep, but Sunday, May 8th, yes. Whenever you hear this, make sure you go to the 30 to Life pod page or Brown's page to see more about Daddy's Weekend. Now, to go back to the R word, which is racism, we have a special guest by the name of Matthew Kincaid. He's a former social studies teacher. He's a school administrator, and he's the CEO and chief consultant officer of Overcoming Racism. He has done a lot of great things in our community. He's received so many great awards, right, from 100 Visionary Leaders to Young Entrepreneur of the Year to receiving the Gambit's 40 Under 40 recognition. So he's just doing a lot of great things, right? And we wanted to bring him on just to kind of talk about racism in general, but more of like, you know, how he transitioned from a teacher to full-time entrepreneur, really like talking about the stereotypes, right? We had an episode not too long ago, just about like redefining what the stereotypes of Black men and really just what he does in the community, right? Which is serving and, you know, bringing an increase in representation in our community. So with that, thank you so much for coming on, Matthew.
Yeah, definitely an honor. Feel blessed to be here. So, you know, thank you so much for having me and excited to chop it up with you all.
Yes. So before we get into the R word, let's learn a little more about yourself. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Yeah. In a lot of ways, you know, my life has kind of been defined by this journey and this mission. I've actually been leading anti-racism intensive since I was 14. And so, you know, that transition into me becoming a teacher, I taught 7th and 8th grade social studies in New Orleans, in Holly Grove. Most people know about Holly Grove because of Lil Wayne, but that was a community where I taught. And then was later a school administrator at that school as well. I saw that every day, some of the most brilliant, bright, curious young people come in and out of our school doors. And I saw that they were facing massive disparities, both outside of school and obstacles and barriers. And then with good hopes and intentions and faith, oftentimes we replicated those barriers even inside of school. So really the founding of Overcoming Racism started with doing anti-racism training at our school when I moved into leadership. In a year, we reduced our suspensions by 75% while improving our school performance, indicators. And, you know, other school leaders started asking, like, how did you do this? How did you do this? And, you know, on the road to eliminating suspensions entirely. And so started working with schools around the city and then around the country. And then now we work with nonprofits, corporations, educational organizations, healthcare providers, the list goes on. So the organization has really grown, even extending outside the United States on a few other continents as well.
Yeah. So you said that you've been doing this anti-racism activism since you were 14. Where did that interest come from?
You know, it's a really interesting question. I think there's a lot of different antecedents to me kind of following along this path. But the thing that I point to most directly is that I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri. Anyone who's familiar with St. Louis is a very hyper-segregated city. I lived in an almost exclusively Black neighborhood for pretty much all of my childhood, but I went to majority white schools. And so my childhood was spent navigating these two extremely different worlds, both in terms of the wealth of the students who I went to school with, in terms of the race of the students who I went to school with. And I saw just upfront from a very early age that people were treated differently based upon how much money they had or what color of skin they were. And for me as a kid, like there wasn't very many people to explain that to me. If I asked my parents questions about it, they're like, you're in that good school, don't make waves. Like you're not there to make friends, just, you know, get your studies. And if I asked my teachers about it, almost all of whom were white, they couldn't relate to the things that I was going on as I navigated that environment. So, you know, in a lot of ways, without me knowing it, I think that kind of radicalized me navigating those two nuanced environments. And then I met a woman by the name of Sharice Jackson. She was running a program called Anytown. It was a youth leadership program where they taught students about racism, sexism, classism, homophobia, the list goes on. And so I went through that program and later became a facilitator for that program. And it really, in a lot of ways, just kind of defined the purpose for my life moving forward.
Yeah. So you mentioned that when you went into leadership, that the rates of the negative rates of the school, dropout rates decreased. Do you equate that to critical race theory or the structuralized racism? Like why is it that we have these segregated schools and high dropout rates in our communities? Like, is that a direct result of critical race theory or the structural racism? Or can you,
Yeah, to break that down a few different ways, because it's question, but I guess to answer the first, I'll get to the critical race theory question like after this, but I guess to answer kind of what I attribute the drop of the suspension race to, while also improving our school performance score, is that, yeah, I think that what my students experienced both inside and outside of school was deeply entrenched in not just the dynamics of racism that my students had to navigate in their lived experiences, but also generations of neglect, generations of what Dr. Gloria Lassen-Billings calls an education debt, where some communities are invested in as it pertains to education and other communities are divested from. And so when people would ask me, like, how did you all so dramatically reduce your suspensions while also improving your students' test scores? And, you know, my cheeky answer to that is like, well, believe it or not, when you decide to stop suspending kids and kids spend more time in school, they do better on their tests. And what we find is that school, Pedro Neguera talks about like this social contract that school is predicated on. It's very simple. All schools run based on the same social contract. Students are asked to exchange basic rights and freedoms. Okay, so you can't just get up whenever you want to. You can't holler out whenever you want to. The teacher asks you to do something, you're supposed to do it. They assign work, you're supposed to bring it in. You give up basic rights and freedoms in exchange for education. That's a pretty good deal, because we say that education means that you're going to make more money and live longer and all these wonderful things. But I can look predictably across the country at who that social contract oftentimes doesn't work for. That when these students give up those rights and freedoms, they still oftentimes don't receive the education they deserve. Children of color, children in the LGBTQIA plus community, poor kids, kids who experience trauma, kids who are taught by inexperienced teachers, where Black and brown kids are two times more likely to be taught by a first-year teacher than their white counterparts, or students who don't feel like their learning in school is relevant to their lived experience. So you would think that if we like knew this, that we have this social contract is working for most kids, but there's these predictable groups of kids that we know it's not working for, we would just change the system. We would ensure that those kids are included in the fabric of what makes education work for these kids over here. We don't do that. If I were to list the groups of kids that are disciplined the most, it will be the exact same list, right? We just discipline those kids more. We just oftentimes like push those kids out of school more frequently. So what we did at our school was we flipped that dynamic on its head. And by engaging students in culturally responsive pedagogy, by engaging teachers in anti-racism training, we were able to, you know, dramatically shift our policies and practices and shift students' experience in schools.
So you mentioned anti-racism. So I would love to, you know, go dive deeper into exactly what that is. And then can you also elaborate on critical race theory?
Yeah, so let me like talk about what critical race theory is and why the word anti-racism and critical race theory might be conflated. So it's really fascinating. I was kind of mentioning before we started that I pretty much can't go anywhere without talking about critical race theory now. But if you just went back a year ago, maybe like a year and some change ago,
never heard of
no one asked me anything about critical race theory. All right. You know, I didn't find out that I was a quote unquote critical race theorist until I was getting chased out of a Florida district. And, you know, if you Googled my name up until that point, there were no mentions of the word critical race theory in my name until, you know, parents and a local politician like led this press conference about these dangerous people coming into schools and teaching about racism. Let me define critical race theory for you, because most people who engage in this conversation like don't know what it is. And that's not even necessarily like a jab at those people. Critical race theory is generally a fairly obscure legal theory, which if you are not a legal scholar, and quite frankly, if you're not a legal scholar that specifically focuses on the ways in which the law can eliminate disparities based on race, you still probably in law school didn't take courses in critical race theory. So unless you're doing a job like the one that I'm doing where you study race or you're a legal scholar, you know, this up until now probably wasn't a term you're familiar of. Critical race theory though has been around since the late 1960s, early 1970s. So if it was this like proverbial boogeyman that is kind of being deemed to be now, then we're a little bit late to the party and worrying about it because it's been around for a very long time. It wasn't until certain news networks and local politicians made it this frontline issue that anyone really cared about it or wondered whether or not it had mischievously infiltrated schools. So here's the most simple definition of critical race theory I can give, and then I can talk about how that's similar to my work and how that's different from my work, because I'm technically not a critical race theorist because I didn't go to law school and I'm not a legal scholar. So in the late 60s, early 70s, we probably know what was going on around that time. King is killed in 68. You're talking about the rise of the Black Power movement. You're talking about the extension of the civil rights movement. People in legal scholarship were studying how the law has been used to maintain racism over time, and that oftentimes activists like Dr. King and Rosa Parks, the list goes on, they were fighting laws, right? This is why what their actions were deemed civil disobedience. And so the question was, well, if the law has been used to uphold racism, could the law be used as a tool to dismantle racism? And so what critical race theory is strictly is a study of how the law can be used as a tool and a vehicle to dismantle both legacies of racist policy as well as racist policies that exist today. Pretty much everything that, you know, talking heads on, say, Fox News, et cetera, are saying about critical race theory is just a falsification, a fictionalization of the study, which is crazy because almost all, if not all, of the critical race theorists who invented this in the 70s are still alive and still talking about it now. So if you really want to know what it is, just like ask the people that coined the term. In terms of whether or not critical race theory is currently being taught in K-12 schools, I work in schools all over this country. We work in almost every single state in this country outside of Alaska and Hawaii. And I have not been in any school that a majority of teachers could tell you what critical race theory was or in which critical race theory was being taught in schools. It's a myth. It is an example similar to like the Southern strategy of the Nixon years of using white supremacy to stoke up racial fears, to mobilize, you know, voters to promote a certain political agenda. This notion that, oh my gosh, in your schools, these teachers are teaching anti-white curriculum is very effective to mobilize white voters. But unfortunately, you know, it's not based on any reality or any truth. And so the work that I do is similar to critical race theory, because that is the examination of how we can eliminate racism in law. And my work is about how we can eliminate racism in all institutions, right? And so if there's a similarity, it's there. But you know, as I said, our work is mostly on focusing on either the teachers in schools or folks in businesses and corporations on how we can create equal and equitable institutions that we all exist in. Knows a lot, but it's like hard to explain.
That's good. That's great. So how do we eliminate racism in all of these systems?
Yeah. So how much time do you have?
We got time today.
You know, it's a super complicated question. I'll do my best to simplify something that, you know, probably we'd have to do a series of podcasts if we were really trying to get down to the meat of that question. There's a few things that are really important to understand when you talk about dismantling systems of oppression. The first thing is that these systems of oppression at a net level do not serve really any of us, unless like maybe you're a billionaire or like super wealthy or in the elite, you're in that 1% that controls 99% of the wealth, then like, yeah, like you're pretty solid. But for the most part, whether it be white supremacy, sexism, homophobia, like whatever these institutions are, even the people who are supposedly the beneficiaries of those systems still have to deal with the consequences of the fact that these systems are built upon and predicated on untruths, right? White supremacy is the belief that white people are superior to, you know, people of color. We know that that's not founded in truth. And we know that in this country, unfortunately, over the course of many generations, we have passed law after law after law after law to try to legitimize these massive disparities that we see between white people and people of color across pretty much every spectrum of life, education, healthcare, voting access, wealth, like whatever. Instead of recognizing that these disparities are the result of a system which requires systemic change. So to simplify it, you know, most of our initiatives of ending racism have been aimed at individuals. The idea is if we can just teach a critical mass of people that racism is bad, then those people will stop mistreating people because of the color of their skin and racism will poof and go away. But the reality is that racism is not now and has never been solely predicated on what individual people believe, or even quite frankly, how they act on those beliefs. Racism is a byproduct of racist policy. And so if you want to eliminate racism, you have to focus on eliminating racist policy. Racist policies that minimize people's access to voting access, racist policies that force some students into failing school, racist policies that make it harder for Black women to have children in this country, and we see massive disparities in that, racist policies that impact people's ability to build and attain and hold on to wealth, racist policies that have historically elevated some groups over others, like redlining or housing policy or the New Deal policies, where between 1934 and 1968, the federal government underwrote $120 billion worth of home loans for white families, while less than 2% of those benefits went to people of color. And so that's the focus of our work. Yes, it's about changing hearts and minds because people make up systems, but the reality is it's mostly about changing structures and policies. And by shifting structures and policies, you're more likely to shift thoughts and minds, if that makes sense. I'll give you an example, right? Like, you know, the Civil Rights Act, you know what I'm saying? Like integrates the country and, you know, makes it where it's illegal to discriminate based on race. It's not like that act or that law or that policy was passed and all of a sudden, like, people all over the South are like, oh yeah, like this is cool. Like, you know, I'm happy and excited that, you know, this is gonna happen. But because people then had access to these buildings and these institutions, you could sit in the front of the bus, you could go in the store, whatever the case may be, it was the policy that actually drove public opinion about that over time. People are typically more accepting of something once there's already been a policy change versus this notion of let's get everybody on board for this and then we'll change the policy once we've already garnered the acceptance. You can talk about gay marriage, right? And the ways in which, like, after gay marriage was legalized, you started to see, you know, people becoming much more accepting of that as an institution than people were when it was illegal. And we saw the same thing with abortion rights and the list goes on.
It's like some weird human behavioral thing, huh? Like,
yeah.
as soon as you federalize it in some shape or form, people take hold of it. Interesting.
Yeah, let's get reparations passed.
Well, yeah. Well, that's a big one, you know, and unfortunately, you know, we're a little further on that one in terms of getting the public interest. But yeah, I mean, reparations would actually be a really good example. And the thing is, you know, people actually aren't against reparations. You know, we are kind of socialized to believe that people are against reparations because Black folks haven't received them. But almost every other targeted or oppressed group in this country has received reparations one time or another, including slave owners. You know, slave owners receive, you know, even in our nation's capital, receive reparations after the Emancipation Proclamation for their quote unquote loss of property. Yeah. So we're good with reparations as a country. We dole them out all the time. It's just when it comes to talking about reparations for Black folks, all of a sudden it becomes a taboo subject.
I had a question, right? Because I'm like, you know, studying like, you know, our movement amongst our Black community, but I noticed like talking points that, you know, politicians may use or in general, right? They use this term like people of color, right? And we know that when we use the term minority, that it dilutes our experience in terms of participating in, you know, a lot of equity, right? I think there was a study done that we received 2% of a lot of these different contracts or grants where other minorities receive it, who didn't really participate in our suppression, our suffering and oppression over, you know, 400 years. So why is it common language now to use the term people of color when, when you look at other ethnicities, they use their actual term, but we always defer to the term of color when we know that we need to get, you gotta get really granular and say Black for it to be a certain way. And it seems like it's common language for even us to say it. So can you talk a little bit about that? And do you think there's any effect on our progress by diluting our term of being Black in this country?
You know, it's really challenging because one of the things that white supremacy does really well is it pits different groups of people together. It makes it really hard for us to work together. I think, you know, one of the, you know, obviously like people of color, Black people are the like most visceral victims of white supremacy. But white supremacy really is a con that is targeted at white people who are poor. And the dynamic of this is that white people who are poor would be far better off if you look at the long stretch of history by like aligning themselves with Black people and people of color more broadly, whether you talk about labor rights, whether you talk about even like women's rights, voting rights, like the list goes on. A lot of the issues that white people who are poor experience are similar, not the same, to a lot of the issues that, you know, Black people experience and people of color more broadly. But one of the ways that we maintain white supremacy is that we subdivide people across all these different groups. And so I think the reason why the term people of color started becoming popularized was because Black people were like, well, we're the ones who are doing a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of like elevating the collective rights of this country. Yes, we're trying to elevate our rights, but when we get something passed like the Voting Rights Bill, it doesn't just impact Black voters. It also enfranchises other voters of color. A lot of people don't know that there were these extremely racist immigration laws on the books that limited the number of people who could come from specific Asian countries based on a whole bunch of racist factors that came off the books as a result of civil rights legislation that was hard fought for by people in the Black community, but it also enfranchised other groups of color. So I think what we saw in the Black community was like, we're fighting for all these rights. These rights are benefiting everyone, white people, people of color who are not Black, the list goes on. But when it comes down to there being like a Black issue that's truly a Black issue, and we use the word Black, no one shows up for it but other people who look like us. So maybe we use this term people of color because these rights are benefiting all people of color. More people of color will see themselves aligned with our struggle. And I think where your point is really salient is that that hasn't necessarily happened, is that in some ways we try to use the term to bring people in, but what we see is that anti-Blackness is still a major feature of the, you know, structural design of white supremacy more broadly. And so you're right, we do need to be able to drill down to the fact that a lot of these issues either are specifically impact Black people or they disproportionately impact Black people. But unfortunately, you know, as I mentioned with reparations and a lot of these other dynamics, when we talk about these issues as solely Black issues, we not only lose the white community, we also lose a lot of potential allies and other communities of color. And so I think it's like a balancing act that we're still trying to figure out. But you were right. I mean, the accuracy of language is very important when you talk about shifting massive systems that have been maintained for a very long time and are very resistant to change.
Yeah, it's tough because I get it. Like, you know, of color includes more people, which can, you know, bring larger numbers, which effectively can create change. But, you know, after reading a couple books on, like, you know, the coin term minority and everything, we're still getting, you know, the 2-3% of those different things. Any, just look at it. Anything that we fight for, that company that comes out, they'll say we started a minority training group or we're starting this. And a lot of times we're the last ones to take advantage of those benefits. Like, it's just, let's call it what it is. Look at the PPP loan. I mean, the paycheck protection loans that we had, we missed out on a lot of that, right? And it's supposed to go to the ones that are disenfranchised or having issues with their businesses, but we were the last ones to know about it. And we just look at all these other policies. When I'm reading it, I see it, the coin term minority. And minority is just expanding and expanding, expanding, expanding. And I feel like we're getting drowned out in a lot of instances. And I just see, when you look at other groups, they specifically says, hey, I'm in this group and this is what I'm fighting for. But I see us as people saying we're fighting for people of color. And I think that that's a drastic different ways that they're handling it. And I don't know what we can do to fix it, because I see on one end, as you say, like, it's bringing more people included into it, but it's also diluting it where we may not have the direct of change that we're looking for. So what do we do in that instance?
Well, I think the reality is, if you look at Black people in the United States, I mean, we have used every term, every slogan, every song, every method. Like, we've used every imaginable pathway to not only advance our own rights in this country, but in turn to advance the rights of pretty much everyone who's existed here. We fought in every single war that this country has fought, even the wars that it came about before the United States was officially a country. So it becomes really hard for me when I'm doing even my work and I'm thinking about, like, okay, well, what is the best strategy here? Because, you know, a lot of times we always, like, get into this dynamic around, you know, is this protest palatable to, like, the white population? Is this protest palatable to our potential allies of color that don't look like us? Like, is this the right way? Is that the right way? It kind of reminds me of a Toni Morrison quote, which I have to paraphrase because it's not in front of me. But, you know, basically it says, like, you know, first they told us that we had no history, and then they told us that our heads weren't shaped properly, and then they told us that we had no art. So we went in and found that, and then we went and found this, and we went and found this. There will always be one more thing. And so, you know, what she was really talking about is the fact that one of the core functions of racism is distraction, right? We get so distracted by chasing down the perfect way to say, you know, is it defund the police, or people don't like that term? Is it abolition? Oh, we can't say that. Is it, we need to systematically reduce resources in policing and move it. Like, we keep finding ourselves in this, like, Cupid shuffle of trying to find the right ingredients that will move people's moral compass to, for them to, like, align themselves with our mission. And what I've found is that there is no perfect palatable protest for the white masses, which is why the work that we do, education and things like that, is so critically important. Because there's never been a time in this history where the racial literacy of this country has met the current activism of this country. And so instead of us having the same conversation, oftentimes we're having different conversations. So I think that was kind of a cop-out to answer your question in some ways, but at the same time, like, yes, I do believe that we need to be very specific when we're talking about Black issues, but I also don't think that the sole use of the term people of color is the main reason why folks don't care about Black issues. I don't think folks care about Black issues because they don't care about Black people. And I think that, you know, the dehumanization of Black people over time is really the thing that we need to be focusing on, versus, like, the words that we use to promote our freedom movements.
I was just thinking, like, as someone who studies racism, and being that the concept of race didn't even come into existence until the 17th century, like, how do you feel about it being so heavily discussed even today? Given that the concept is just it's a man-made concept. There's no biological reasoning behind race at all. It's just socially constructed.
Yeah, you know, race is a socially constructed dynamic. Race is not real. Spoiler alert to anyone who like was not aware of that. Like, race is not a real thing. Race is, as you said, an invention. Normally I would be like an invention of humankind. So I could be like gender inclusive, but like literally like dudes made this up. Like, it's an invention of mankind. Like, it was a group of men who were in rooms who were like, how can we write laws and systems and policies that specifically benefit us? Like, I want folks to be clear that the goal of white supremacy was never, and it's not now, about enfranchising all white people. Actually, you know, one of the major functions of white supremacy, especially how it functioned in this country, was to separate white people who were poor from people of color so that you wouldn't have a political uprising of the poor against the ruling class, which was very happy to oppress anyone that didn't exist within their income bracket. And so when you talk about when, you know, Africans are stolen and brought here against their will, well, there was already a labor force in this country. A lot of people think when they look at history, they're like, oh yeah, you know, black people were enslaved and that's how this all was built. Like, nah, European indentured servants were here for at least a decade before Africans were stolen and brought to this country. And when Africans were stolen and brought to this country, they were placed in that same system of indentured servitude until these notions of quote unquote white supremacy was used to create a buffer class between the ruling and owning class and the labor force. And you know, not only did that like keep those white people confined to poverty, but of course it kept, we know the story of what happened to black people as a consequence of that. And so instead of us seeing ourselves aligned horizontally, instead, you know, because white supremacy is a con, those white folks who were newly freed from indentured servitude were told, well, you're a Christian and you are white. And, you know, as a result of the 1705 acts of, I'm forgetting the exact name of the act, it'll come to me, but the 1705 act that freed European indentured servants, you know, they were given muskets. And it was like, yo, you got a gun, you got some land, you look like me, we are in the same religion, you're like me. Meanwhile, you know, the wealthy white folks weren't educating poor white children. Meanwhile, those white folks, it wasn't like they were then able to like purchase and own enslaved people. Meanwhile, they weren't getting access to healthcare, like the list goes on. And so this whole system was created to create divisions and to maintain an economic system, as I mentioned earlier, where less than 1% of the population holds over 99% of the wealth. So it's difficult for me to talk about systemic racism on a daily basis because, yeah, we're applying theory to something at the end of the day, which is not real, but it is real because over time it has been affirmed and legitimated through policy. As a consequence of that, it is very real in the way that it plays out today. And that can be very confusing to folks.
Yeah, it's so true that, you know,
sorry about that. 1705 Act concerning servants and slaves. It was just like, boom, hit me. I had to get out real quick. Go ahead.
Good. No, so no. Yeah, I was just saying in terms of like MLK, like that was that's, you know, his speeches changed to, you know, the Poor People's March and, you know, really, you know, back to what we were talking about before, how do we mobilize more people so that we can affect change? That was one of the things that where, you know, people in general started be like, hey, we got to pay attention even more because now he's trying to get other people involved. And that's where it started getting dangerous, right? So, and ultimately assassinated, but it's so true. It's a man-made, you know, term. And like, so how do we eliminate it? Like what you talk about, you know, policies to get rid of racism, but how do we get rid of race?
I think you teach that, like you teach that racism or race is a man-made construct. And it began in the 1700s by who, what and when and where and how. And that's just what I think you need to start off with, not what we start off with when we're in school, which is the transatlantic slave trade and all that stuff. But go ahead. Sorry.
No, yeah. I mean, you know, Brown, you're exactly right. And, you know, one of the things that we do in our workshops is that we teach about why white supremacy is also not at a net level, you know, advancing white people the way that I think oftentimes it is positioned to do so. Now, am I saying that white privilege doesn't exist? Well, no, of course not. But what I am saying is that the privileges that white people receive as a consequence of white supremacy are not scarce. And that is like the worst kept secret in terms of the maintenance of these structures. If police stop beating and brutalizing Black kids in urban communities, it's not like they would have to go into the suburbs and start cracking skulls there. If when I walked into an institution, a public space, I wasn't, you know, looked at through the stereotypical lens, or I was given the benefit of the doubt, or people assumed good intentions of me, it's not like all of a sudden those things would no longer be true for white people. If our textbooks included more images and narratives of people of color, you know, specifically Black people and their contribution into the history of this country, especially the intellectual contributions to the history of this country, it's not like we'd have to take all the white people out of the textbooks. So the worst kept secret and the biggest myth of this is that at the end of the day, folks are being asked to trade their culture and their humanity in exchange for rights and privileges that are not even scarce, that could be extended to all of these groups of people to no loss of their own. And as a consequence of that, we will be far better positioned to actually make a society where the people who are suffering, who are white and who are poor, whose factories left their communities, who are being undereducated in rural communities, the list goes on, they also would be getting the things that they need and that they deserve. They would benefit from universal pre-K. They would benefit from universal healthcare. They would benefit from the, you know, debt forgiveness and these different things from loan. But a lot of times folks in those communities don't advocate for those things because of these like mythical boogeyman that is race and white supremacy and the fact that they're still being kind of conned into being that buffer class. So for me, I don't think that the idea of ending racism is as insurmountable as we are socialized to believe it is. But what keeps us from doing that is that too many people have fallen for this con, and we've become so comfortable within these structures, or people have been so comfortable accepting these artificial benefits and privileges that they can't see that we would all be better off if we work together. And this is how, in the midst of a pandemic, where people of all races, people have died, people's businesses have closed to never open again, people have lost their homes, the list goes on. And in the midst of all of this economic calamity, billionaires are like, yo, you know what? This will be a great time to like build a spaceship and go to space. And the reason why like no one cares about that, and it's just like, oh, cool. Like, ooh, is it gonna be Elon Musk, or is it gonna be Jeff Bezos? Like, who's gonna, you know, colonize space first? Instead of us looking around and being like, everyone is suffering. And yet there are people in this country have enough money to, on their spare time, like start a space program. Maybe we should be focusing on that. Maybe we should be focusing on this economic insecurity instead of focusing on like who's coming to the southern border or who's immigrating from another country, or you know what this person in just a few towns over from me looks like. We have a lot more in common than we do that separates us, but the US has done a very good job of using these definitions of race and gender and sexuality, and the list goes on, to subdivide people so much that we don't look up and recognize that like we're all losing in this economic structure that we've built.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to bring up, because you brought up a good point. After 9/11, I think that was the one time where it was no longer about race. Anyone who was Muslim, you know, got treated a certain way. But I think people for a moment forgot, hey, I'm Black, I'm white, I'm this. And it was like, I'm American, right? It was like the one time for at least a year or so where it was just like, I'm American. Like, you saw flags, everyone's just like, we're one person, right? And it was like, it was interesting in the way that was during that time. Do you remember that? Like how we were like focused on like one, you know, America and everything. And it was like through those moments where it's like, we're capable of doing this, right? Why can't we like sustain this? And it shouldn't be from a form of tragedy, but it should be from, you know, a point of like victory, overcoming and stuff. So just thinking about that. But I wanted to just pivot and go back to something earlier when you actually was a teacher. You're a Black man, right? And it's very few Black men and education in general. Do you think? I'm sorry.
Less than 3% of public school educators are Black men.
Yes. So do you think that if we, I guess, normalize Black men going into education, that it would have a profound impact on Black males in public school education?
You got to pay more. I think that's what it is. Go ahead.
Well, yeah. Yes. So one of the things that I was gonna, you know, talk about is the fact that like teachers are grossly underpaid. There are a lot of cities. where teachers aren't even paid a living wage, where, you know, teachers have to have multiple jobs just to make ends meet. And I think a lot of the additional pressures that exist just being Black, period, where you're a Black man or a Black woman or, you know, Black and trans, whatever the case may be, you know, it doesn't always make it the most attractive of professions. But, you know, one of the things that I think is really important to understand is that, like, we can get a critical, yes, the answer is yes, it does matter. There have been studies to suggest that a student who has access to, a Black student has access to a Black teacher between, I want to say, second and fifth grade, like, there are all these indicators of, like, how that will, just one Black teacher, how that will impact their potential of, like, dropping out, how that'll impact their grades, how that'll impact their potential of potentially being suspended in school. Like, the data is very clear that representation matters when it comes to, you know, having Black folks in school. So yes, we need more Black educators. But with that being said, we also have to make sure that we're not trying to assimilate Black educators into an education system that doesn't work for Black educators or Black kids. And so if we're going to keep Black educators, if we're going to allow Black educators to be themselves and to work their magic in classrooms, we also have to examine our outdated education system and the ways in which that system was built on Eurocentric practices. And yes, it has been effective in educating white children, but the data says that it has not been as effective in educating Black and brown children. A lot of people will point to, like, Asian Americans, and they'll be like, well, it's been effective in educating Asian Americans, but that's even a certain population of Asian Americans. Asian Americans actually have one of the largest education disparities of any group in this country. We just don't talk about the groups of Asian Americans that, you know, Hmong students, Vietnamese students, the list goes on, that are facing massive education disparities in schools and face many of the same broken structures that Black and Indigenous kids experience in schools. And so, yes, I think that the representation matters piece is really critical, but I also think that we need a fundamental examination of what is the purpose of school, who's included in our definition of success, and, you know, how can we make sure that that definition is widened to include all students, and not just students from certain communities or certain economic backgrounds, or certain racial groups.
Yeah, so that leads me to, like, your transition. So you left school to start your own company. Can you talk to us more about that?
Yeah, you know, it's really, I never set out to be an entrepreneur. I did not go to business school. I have no educational training in entrepreneurship. I did apply to some, like, you know, 6 month or 1 year business incubation programs and things like that. But, like, I mean, you know, starting a business was never something on my radar. You know, I talk a lot to, like, kids. And, you know, as a Black kid, like, have either of you all, when y'all were kids, anyone ever tell you, like, you can be anything you want to be? You could be the president of the United States, right? And the thing is, like, when we were kids, like, that wasn't even true. Like, it's kind of true for the kids now, because, like, we've at least had a Black president. But, like, yeah, when we were kids, like, that was, like, just a blatant lie. Like, you can be anything you want to be. But even in that dynamic of telling, like, Black children, like, you can be the president, almost no one ever goes to the Black kids and be like, you can be an entrepreneur. Like, that's just not something that we hear. Like, the cap for us in terms of, like, you've reached the pinnacle of excellence is what, two fields? See, we have the same ones.
Oh, sports?
Sports and
entertainment.
Rap, yeah. Hip-hop.
Yeah, so you have, like, sports and hip-hop. But if you were to go, like, outside of that in terms of, like, an academic field where, like, a Black family is, like, this is, like, the pinnacle of what the two professions that you could be. Not the ones that we actually get to fit into, but the ones where it's, like, if you make it there, you go and go through school and you make it there, you can be this profession, and you've arrived in the Black world.
For us, or just for society? This
question.
No, for Black people, like,
doctor and a lawyer.
Doctor and a lawyer. Like, okay. That has always been the, like, as far as, like, the academic side of things, like, that's, like, the, ooh, you know, you be a doctor or a lawyer, like, you made it, like, whatever the case may be. Okay. And of course, like, sports and entertainment and
society, yep.
Whatever, like, that's the places where we're, like, you know, filtered into, and we have been able to find some success. But, you know, no one ever talks about entrepreneurship. It's very rarely talked about in our community, even though entrepreneurship is, like, one of the main vehicles where Black people have been able to develop and maintain wealth, you know, barbers, you know, people who, you know, work in our community, people who wash cars, like, the list goes on. Like, yes, we have a lot of formal business structures, but we also have just a lot of, like, in our DNA, people who hustle and are, like, running their own businesses, you know, that, you know, maybe aren't, like, as structurally sound as what, you know, you would a brick and mortar business, what the case may be. So entrepreneurship was not on my radar screen. I don't know if I can think of, I had an aunt that was an entrepreneur, and I still don't know if like anyone ever told me like, you know what, you could be an entrepreneur. Like, never. I think I knew what the word meant. Couldn't spell it then, probably can't spell it now. But the point is that like, for me, I started my company out of necessity. Like, once I saw how broken the education system was from an adult perspective, once I saw that my students had all of the skills and talents and abilities that their white counterparts have, but just were navigating this just absolutely broken structure that was very directly holding them back. And once I saw that I had some effectiveness in shifting that, I just started doing it. And over time, it just made sense to kind of like transition outside of my school experience where I could impact 400 kids a year to this business structure where now, you know, I can work with hundreds of schools across the country, you know, on a yearly, on an annual basis. So for me, I feel like entrepreneurship found me. I didn't really find entrepreneurship.
So through your journey of entrepreneurship, and now that you have all this level of success, you know, just changing the lives of, you know, students everywhere, what would you say is like your biggest takeaway or lesson that you learned?
I guess about entrepreneurship specifically, I want to be very clear. It is not for everyone. You know, I'm definitely not about to go on, you know, everybody started LLC. Right? You know what I'm saying? Like, it's not, you know what I'm saying? It's not for everyone, you know, and that's okay. Like, you know, whatever the case may be. But what I would say though, is that it probably is for more people than what we think, right? And I think that it is something that people should at least think about and explore. If you have a particular gift or skill or talent that you can give to the world, you don't have to be a Fortune 400 company. Like, you can be an entrepreneur and just have that be something that helps to, you know, supplement whatever your, you know, 9-to-5 income is or whatever the case may be. So I think that's the first thing, you know, looking at a person like myself who, if someone told me as a kid that I was going to be a business owner, you know, I probably would have like laughed in their face to like where I am now. I do wish that like we exposed more young people to this field, because I do think that there are a lot of, especially us in our community, I think there's a lot about Black culture that's entrepreneurial in itself. And so I do wish that more, you know, Black kids were exposed to the field of entrepreneurship. It's probably like the first thing. And then, you know, I think the second thing is that I learned way more from just the first few years of running my business than I ever learned in probably any academic institution in my entire life. You know what I'm saying? You know, middle school, high school, college, the list goes on. Like, in those first few years of being a business owner, I feel like I packed in a doctorate and some. And so, you know, for folks who are like educated outside of the traditional structure, you know, that doesn't mean that you don't have just as much to give to the world, and that your form of education isn't just as valid as a person who has, you know, a degree or a piece of paper.
Okay, so last question.
And before that question,
my back. Go ahead.
I just see he has John Lewis in the back. So This is the most important question.
Yes.
Okay. So Brown, take it from there.
All right. So how are you redefining your Black experience?
How am I redefining my Black experience? What a great question. How am I redefining my Black experience? You know, I think it's a really hard question to answer now, because like the world feels like it's like crumbling in on itself. And, you know, thinking about John Lewis, like a lot, the reason why I keep John Lewis behind me is because it's a reminder of like the people who came before me and just like how hard it is to make change. And I feel like, you know, John Lewis died in a version of America that was regressing. And so, you know, you fight your entire life, you become this big civil rights icon, you see these massive shifts. And then before you get to like, you know, get your final rest, you start to see that like all the things that you were fighting for are being targeted again to be dismantled. And I just always wonder like what that felt like. And so I guess like, just the word you use, I want to say revolution, but
redefine.
I guess if I were going to say the way that I'm redefining my Black experience is like just having the audacity to believe beyond what makes sense. You know, there's this phenomenal quote by Paulo Freire, who writes the book Pedagogy of the Oppressed, that says, it is imperative that we maintain hope, even when the harshness of reality suggests otherwise. It is imperative that we maintain hope, even when the harshness of reality suggests otherwise. If there's one thing that white supremacy, patriarchy, the list goes on, is designed to do, it is designed to steal our hope. I mean, just look at what folks woke up to this morning, where millions of women across this country and really across the globe, because what the United States does is oftentimes a symbol for policy across the world, you know, woke up to one of their fundamental rights being potentially on the chopping block. That's a moment that can feel very hopeless. But like, I have to remind myself that that's what these systems are designed to do. And the people who are actively doing their work to like maintain these structures, they don't take a break. They don't take a beat. They don't take a breath. People have been fighting to get Roe overturned since 1973 when it was passed. Like, consistent. Building up the building blocks to this moment. And, you know, I think the same way about our activism. And so for me, I think that I am trying to create a world for myself where freedom first exists in my mind, where if the United States isn't going to fully enfranchise me and make me free, I can still be free here. I can still be free with other people that look like me. I can still have joy in the midst of situations that would normally cause despair. And so, you know, I'm trying to redefine my Black experience by not being defined by the American experience. And that's easier some days than it is other days. But it is definitely the way that I'm trying to keep myself sane in the midst of the calamity.
Great answer.
Thank you. Really great question. Yeah, I'm going to have to go back and sleep on that one and see if this is something tomorrow.
Oh yeah. No, but yeah, so true, right? Everything starts in your mind, right? Like, if like freedom starts in your head, like your hope starts in your head, right? And then it just flows throughout your body and, you know, and onto others, right? It's contagious. So, you know, I love, you know, what you're doing, and, you know, you're helping others. And, you know, you took a shot on yourself, right? By starting your own business, you know, leaving, you know, something stable to essentially affect change for others, right? So, you know, you're doing, you know, great things in the community. We just wish you continued success. Thank you for taking the time and just educating us on, you know, CRT, anti-racism, and, you know, just some of the work that you've done in the past. So with that, where can people find you?
Yeah, our website is overcomingracism.com. If you want to, you know, hit us up for any support for your school, business, organization, et cetera, you can find us there. But, you know, probably the best place to follow us will be Instagram. We kind of try to keep our followers up on what we have going on and have general commentary about racism as well. So these are very critical times, you know. I remember when I was in school and we would talk about the civil rights movement, and all the white kids would look at me and they would be like, yeah, if I was alive in the 60s, I would have drank from the colored water fountain. I would have marched and I would have done these things. Like, we are here right now. This is the civil rights movement. And guess what? It didn't just start. Like, we are smack dab in the middle of a movement. And whatever you're doing right now is the same thing you would have been doing back then. So for anyone who, you know, is listening to this, I really do believe there's the movement inside all of us. Your movement is not my movement, and that's okay. But I definitely encourage folks to try to find what that is.
Great. Perfect. Well, Matthew, thank you so much for coming on. Everyone, make sure you go follow him on Instagram. And once again, don't be stingy. Give to the needy, because the people need to hear the 30 to Life podcast. Make sure you hit that subscribe button. And we just thank you for the support, and keep on redefining the Black experience. It's your boy, Mookie.
And your favorite color in the world, brown.
30 to Life. We out.
Peace.